Welcome to another episode of Not Another Sports Show with your host Neil Parthen and Damian Matthew. Neil,
yeah, welcome
as usual.
This is Not Another Sports Show here on WRFU 104.5 FM. Your progressive look at the world of sports here. But before we get started, as always, the disclaimer.
The disclaimer, yes. WRFU, as usual, is an open forum for the Urbana-Champaign community. Views expressed are those of the speakers and are not intended to represent those of WRFU, the UCIMC, or the Urbana Socialist Forum.
With me, as almost always in the studio, is the Guy Morris to my stolen campus newspapers, Damian Matthew. And we've got a lot to talk about this week. First, as we mentioned last week, Ben Roethlisberger, quarterback of the Pittsburgh Steelers, is under investigation for sexual assault of a 20-year-old college girl. Now, I don't want to get into potential guilt trips here, or, you know, anything like that. I'd rather go into media standards.
Yeah.
Damian, I know we're going to bring up a name that you hate to have on this show.
Yes.
Tiger Woods.
What's he been up to? There's a scandal surrounding him? I hadn't heard anything about it.
Well, you know, I mean, with all this Tiger Woods stuff, we had, you know, Tiger Woods needs to come out and give us every last sort of detail about every sexual exploit and escapade that he was involved in. He's got to give us the details. He's got to make up all the stuff and tell us all the details.
Uh-huh.
Yet with this Ben Roethlisberger case, you don't hear any of that. And DK Wilson had this great piece on Sports in My Mind where he talked about, you know, the nine lessons that we've learned from the Roethlisberger case.
Mm-hmm.
That if you're a white athlete, you're not going to get called to the carpet in front of the media on stuff like this.
Right. Yeah. No, it definitely is a double standard, you know, and it's kind of creepy how it's just sort of unstated, right? It's like, oh, Ben Roethlisberger, we don't need to hear anything about that.
Yeah.
Tiger Woods. I mean, actual, like, consenting relationships between adults, right? Say what you want about the morality of it, you know, outside of wedlock, you know, but, I mean, still, it's odd.
Yeah, you know, nobody's asking him to go in front of Commissioner Goodell. Nobody's asking him to, you know, do all sorts of other stuff that's been asked of Tiger Woods. Nobody's asking for, like, a public apology.
Yeah. No, it's crazy. It's, I don't know.
Now, Damian, I'll let you take this next story since you know, you're a big fan of.
I'm not a huge fan of what the world refers to as football, but I think you know
soccer, Damian. Soccer.
Okay, fine. Oh, anyway, right. So the story is, South Africa is expecting to have about 450,000 people visit their country over the month-long World Cup, and a certain fraction of those. They estimate about 40,000 out of those 450,000 people are very likely going to be prostitutes, basically. That means that nearly 10% of the visitors will be workers in the sex trade. South Africa, however, sees this as no laughing matter. In fact, to those in charge, this is a very serious issue. The effects could be downright terrifying development for a country and its citizens. Davis Bayer, South Africa's deputy chair of the country's central drug authority, said his government feared the large influx of sex workers and pledged in an attempt to stem the tide. It's horrific and very concerning, Bayer said. Money talks, and if you're a sex worker, there is going to be money in South Africa in 2010. Bayer said that passport checks, screening, and profiling will take place at the borders to try to prevent illegal arrivals. He believes the women will be traveling from all over the world, especially Eastern Europe. So, man, you know, it's Well, you know, I mean, these things happen wherever you have any kind of gathering, right? I mean, I guess at the like RNC convention, a lot of sex workers actually came into Minneapolis-St. Paul.
Yeah, and I heard that the profile was like a 13-year-old Laotian boy at that time.
True. I mean, yeah, probably there's going to be a lot more like actual adult women showing up for this one. But
and, you know, I always thought, you know, like with most of these kind of big events like the Olympics and the World Cup and stuff, that the only whores were the, you know, corporate conglomerates that were getting involved in this.
Oh, that's terrible. Okay, anyway.
The World Cup's also drawing international attention for other reasons. In recent reporting by sports writer Dave Zirin, thousands have been forced to from their homes in makeshift shanty towns to make way for new stadiums and to make sure that tourists don't have to see any of the depressing scenes of poverty. The United Nations even issued a complaint on behalf of the 20,000 people removed from the Joe Slovo settlement in Cape Town, called an eyesore by World Cup organizers. Organizers had said that, you know, they don't want us to hear. They don't want us near the stadium, and we have to close the whole place. In addition, FIFA has pushed the South African government to announce that they would arrest any vendors who sell products emblazoned with the words World Cup or even the date 2010.
Yeah, got to trademark that number, right?
Yes.
I think didn't Intel get in trouble with that for like trademarking numbers like the 286 and 386 processor?
Well, that's
it's a number.
Well, that's like the, you know, the reason like Miller Lite had to spell it LITE because they couldn't actually own the word LITE.
Yeah, right. Anyway, okay, so 2010 is going to be a restricted number, right? Okay.
You know, FIFA requirements, and the World Cup has been deemed a protected event by the government, and has passed bylaws that spell out where people may drive and park their cars, where they may and may not trade or advertise, and where they may walk their dogs. They've made clear that beggars or even those found using foul language could be subject to arrest. And then there are the assassinations. In a story that's garnered international news but little buzz in the U.S., two people on a list of 20 have been assassinated for whistleblowing on suspected corruption in the construction of the $150 million Mbombela Stadium. There we go.
Whoa.
You can tell my South African accent is fantastic. The Sunday World newspaper attained the list, which included two journalists and several numerous political leaders. Over 70,000 workers have taken part in strikes connected to World Cup projects since the opening game, since preparations begun, and with 26 strikes since 2007. On March 4th, more than 250 people in a press conference featuring representatives from four provinces threatened to protest the opening game of the Cup unless their various demands were met. And from the New York Times, come June, soccer's World Cup will be hosted by South Africa. Though only four of the 64 games will be played here in Nels Pruitt, a $137 million stadium was built for the occasion. The arena's 18 supporting pylons reach skyward in the shape of orange giraffes. At nightfall, their eyeballs blink with flashes of bewitching light. But the people who live nearby, proud as they are to host soccer's greatest event, also wonder, how could there be money for a 46,000-seat stadium while many of them still fetch water from dirty puddles and live without electricity or toilets?
I mean, it seems like this is just a common theme with all sorts of international athletic events, right? I mean, you have this sort of sanitization going on with the Olympics too. You had it in Vancouver, right? A really sanitized depiction of the city there. I mean, of course, the protests also. We're going to see it in Rio. I mean, it's inevitable. Rio has just a huge amount of abject poverty in the city there, a really oppressive and violent police force that. I guess a lot of their police moonlight as street cleaners, which is a euphemism for people going out and just eradicating homeless kids. This is just this is how things are.
Oh yeah. Dennis Brutus, the anti-apartheid poet and activist. He was on the front lines of this before he unfortunately died at the end of last year, where he was very clearly against this kind of, you know, taking from the poor to give to the rich, the little reverse Robin Hood, if you will.
Right.
Now, we'll be keeping an eye on this story, especially as they're even having trouble selling all the tickets to these games. And so there's a very significant problem there that there's still empty seats.
Right, right.
Now, Damien, I'll let you take this next story because it includes your favorite topic.
Actually, two of my favorite people are included in this story. Tiger Woods is possibly making his return to golf at the Arnold Palmer Invitational on March 25th. And this is according to a report in the New York Post. Media is abuzz over this, and in part because of the comeback, but also because of Tiger's choice for a PR consultant. And he picked none other than Ari Fleischer, the former White House press secretary under Bush II's regime. Fleischer seems to have been attempting some kind of career out of doing PR work within the athletics and sports industry. I mean, this isn't a first for him. He was also a spokesperson for BCS, and he was also, I guess, one of the guys who masterminded the Mark McGwire debacle. Right?
And for those people who aren't sports fans, what is the BCS again?
Oh, it's the Bowl Championship Series. Yeah.
College football.
Right, college football. Right. And so he was the spokesperson for I guess, the big, you know, BCS thing. One striking thing about Fleischer's newly chosen private sector career is that he really seems to suck at it. Right? I mean, I don't think that BCS or Mark McGwire are significantly better off following his assistance. I mean, arguably, I don't know. I don't know what Mark McGwire could have done better.
Well, I mean, you know, you're going to have all those people, you know, as we talked about before when we talked about performance enhancers and the drug war.
Yeah.
And, you know, how this is another expansion of the drug war. I mean, all he's gotten is a slap on the wrist and having to do one of those Jimmy Swagger, I have sinned! You know, yeah. Public apologies.
Right, yeah.
He hasn't gotten anything serious, whereas other people, like we'll talk about later with Marion Jones, have actually gone to jail.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's true. Oh, so maybe Ari's doing a good job. I mean, maybe he does know something.
Hey, and if you can sell two totally illegal, immoral wars to the American public...
There's got
to
be something there.
And sell the idea that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, that Iraq was involved in 9/11, uh-huh. and that both of these things are protecting our freedom, then you're a hell of a PR artist at that point.
Maybe so, maybe so. Maybe he's got something there. Anyway, fairly amusing story. You got something about Tom Morello, right?
Yes, Rage Against the Machine guitarist and resident Cubs baseball fan Tom Morello, and I don't hold his Cubs fandom against him, weighed in on the Chicago Cubs recently via his Twitter account, saying, quote, baseball underway. After LaTroy Hawkins, Jock Jones, Fukudome, and Milton Bradley, I hope Cubs fans can manage to, in all caps, not be racist this year. In a second tweet, read the Cubs fan racism. The slant-eyed t-shirts and the N-word letters sent to the clubhouse are inexcusable, regardless of batting average or ERA. LaTroy Hawkins was the failed closer for the Cubs a few seasons ago, and he constantly got flooded with emails of all sorts of racial epithets. Jock Jones, who struggled in right field for the Cubs, had a whole lot of racist emails and racist taunts. And Milton Bradley even experienced a lot of that. And Bradley did a recent interview saying that many of the fans who booed him, he believed they were racist. Mm-hmm. Saying, quote, I got the same mail LaTroy probably got and the same mail Jacques got. Every time I got mail, I handed over to the PR guy and said, here it goes. It was getting to be so much until I didn't even have to open the letter to know what it was. I could see from the envelope. I could just tell. You get an envelope, no address on it, no postmark. It's just in your mail. How does that even get in your cubbyhole? Yeah. I don't know how that happens. He even talked about how he felt like he was a prisoner in his own home, and his children had even experienced racial epithets That's at their sad. School.
That's really sad.
And he still thinks Chicago's a great city, but even though he had this terrible experience. But, you know, one instance of this is, you know, okay, a mistake. Two instances, eh. Three is starting to be a trend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's happening, Northside fans? Really? Really, you have a Japanese ball player. I know. Let's make a slanty-eyed t-shirt that won't be racist at all. And then, you know, sending in, you know, hate-filled racial epithet letters.
Yeah.
Is just absolutely reprehensible.
Yeah.
But then again, I guess when you haven't won a World Series since 1908, you're willing to blame it on anything.
That is really curious about the unmarked envelope. No addresses or anything. I mean, that's really pretty strange, right?
Yeah. Cubs, 1908. This thing that you're listening to right now, the radio, was invented right about the same time you last won a World Series.
Oh, ouch. Ooh, burn.
One of the big sports stars that we hold in high regard here at Not Another Sports Show is linebacker Scott Fujita, who played for the Super Bowl-winning New Orleans Saints. He did go to the Cleveland Browns in free agency, but before leaving, he donated half of his Super Bowl winnings check to charity. Wow. Half of it went to Haiti Reconstruction, and the other half went to Coastal Restoration in New Orleans.
Good for him.
Very classy way to... Yeah. Leave a city, you know, instead of these full-page ads like, I'm sorry, I signed with another team. I'll always cherish the memories.
Yeah,
whatever. Which actually do something for them rather than sending them, like, a page ad.
Cash, not credit, right?
Exactly.
No, that was really classy of him, definitely. That's no small chunk of money either. Anyway, oh, gosh, we got another soccer story here, don't we? Major League Soccer this time. Major League Soccer players voted to strike if a new labor contract isn't agreed to before the first season opener on March 25th. The league's first collective bargaining agreement, a five-year deal, originally was set to run out January 31st, but was extended twice while negotiations continued. It expired February 25th after the MLS Players Union refused another extension. The union is unhappy with the single entity structure that has been seen the league negotiate all contracts since play began in 1996. Players want greater free agent rights and a higher percentage of guaranteed deals. So, yeah, I mean, it's an ongoing thing, right? The struggle for the working class for labor issues, it's known in sports as well.
Yeah, and, you know, with the whole Major League Soccer thing, like, if you strike and nobody watches the games in the first place, does it really matter?
Come on now. I don't understand this. It's an interesting sport. There's action in it. I mean, maybe they don't score that often, but...
Ariaga, Bariaga, and Ariaga.
Yeah,
you know, like The Simpsons, you know, summed up the anticlimactic aspect of soccer for me.
They don't just stand there, they run around. okay, fine.
Now, we had also mentioned in an earlier episode a class action lawsuit brought against the NCAA and the Collegiate Licensing Company over the use of players' images for commercial purposes. Quite famously, we have the 1992 Christian Laettner shot at Duke versus Kentucky constantly being played, especially with March Madness coming up, with Selection Sunday coming up tomorrow. If you haven't gotten into it already, you can go to ESPN.com, CBSSports.com, or probably talk to one of your many coworkers, because I'm guaranteeing somebody set up a March Madness bracket pool. Originally, the only two named plaintiffs were former UCLA star Ed O'Bannon and former Arizona State-Nebraska quarterback Sam Keller. Recently, new plaintiffs were added, adding some members of the 1966 Texas Western, now Texas at El Paso, basketball team.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's fair that a person is out of college, in my case for 40 years, and the NCAA can make millions off your image, and you get nothing for it, Harry Flournoy, captain of the 1966 Texas Western team, told USA Today in a telephone interview. Lawyers for the NCAA responded to the USA Today stating, the plaintiffs claim that the NCAA violates antitrust laws because it somehow prevents former student athletes from capitalizing on their collegiate images or likenesses is fiction. The number of plaintiffs does not change the fact that the NCAA does not license student athlete likenesses or prevent former student athletes from attempting to do so. Likewise, to claim the NCAA profits off student athlete likenesses is also pure fiction. Well, if that's true, why do you keep running the commercials of famous moments with famous athletes in sport and college sports?
Mm-hmm.
The NCAA has relied heavily on a waiver that can continue that practice, signed by the athletes, allowing member schools in the association to use their likenesses to promote college athletics. The lawsuit could determine how long the NCAA and schools have to continue that practice. Alex Gilbert, who played alongside Larry Bird for Indiana State in the famous 1979 NCAA title game, has also joined the lawsuit. Through Gilbert, we'll be able to tell the story about the incredible commercialization of that game, John King, a lead attorney for the players, said. Eric Riley, who played for Michigan in the early 1990s, when it rose to prominence with the Fab Five, said he wrote to King and asked to join the suit. "Over the years, I keep seeing my image out there," he said. "I felt it was wrong. I'm not bitter about the NCAA or at my school, but everybody is going to cut off the sales. The players should get a part of it."
Yeah.
Now, I can assume that one person really not going to want to cut of that with the Fab Five, and that would be the whole timeout incident with, I believe it was Jalen Rose, if I remember off the top of my head, right? Where he called a timeout in that game and he didn't have one.
Chris Webber? Oh, okay.
Yeah, with us is Brian Tackett, who will be talking with us about education. So I guess it was Chris Webber. Yeah, I get my members of the Fab Five confused at occasionally. Oh, wait. Now, we do have another update from another story, which we mentioned in here just a little bit earlier when we talked about, you know, the Guy Morris who are stolen newspapers.
Yeah, this was this elaborate criminal mastermind who convinced his team to steal newspapers. So, an update from last week. This is about the Texas A&M Commerce newspaper scandal, if you will.
Where's the Law and Order music when you need it?
Dun dun. WRFU does not promote productions from NBC. Texas A&M Commerce coach Guy Morris told campus police the actions by his players were, quote, "the best team-building experience we have ever done." Right? Now, this is in regards to him instructing his players to go out and steal the campus newspaper, right? And they stole, thousands of copies of these, right? Anyway, on Monday, the former Kentucky and Baylor coach apologized for a, quote, "lapse in judgment," and said the comment was made facetiously. Police were investigating the disappearance of newspaper editions that included a front-page article about two football players being arrested on drug charges. A&M Commerce athletic director Carlton Cooper said the Division II program would pay for the reprint of the missing edition and that coaches and players would distribute it. Well, that's some measure of justice anyway.
Well, you know, and but I'm kind of amazed because Guy Morris didn't agree with the policy that the first one's free, but every other one
yeah,
costs.
I know. It's like, yeah, he wanted to dictate a different policy for him, right? He's like, well, you know, this newspaper's handed out for free, and if you open up the front cover, it's like the first copy's free. After that, you're supposed to pay. They stole 2,000 of these things.
And, we've got another college football update if you want to take that one too, Damian.
Oh, sure, yeah. This is from Texas Tech and the story about Mike Leach. Mike Leach will get to present his side of the story under oath when he is deposed by Texas Tech attorneys on Friday as part of the former Red Raiders coach's lawsuit against the school. Leach, who is now living in Key West, Florida, was fired by the school on December 30th, 2 days after suspending him amid allegations that he mistreated a player who had a concussion. His lawsuit includes allegations of libel and slander and breach of conduct, breach of contract. So yeah, this is the rich spoiled brat case, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And it's been difficult to find out what was actually said in these depositions, and I guess
it may be a while before those things are opened up. But
yeah, the Adam James and his son.
That's right.
Going in to start talking about stuff.
What was the son's name now? Yeah, it's on the tip of my tongue. But yeah, basically overprivileged, stuck-up kid.
Yeah.
Can't take criticism.
Yeah, if you listen to past episodes, we've discussed this case at length.
Yeah.
Olympic sprinter Marion Jones, who did jail time for lying about her use of steroids and doping to Congress, has joined the WNBA's Tulsa Shock. And a lot of the media coverage is, why would they sign that person that has that kind of, like, steroid-tinged background? Why would they sign that person? And, you know, it gets into that wide issue of, like, felony reenfranchisement. You know, they went to prison. She served her time.
Yeah.
And now she wants to play basketball again. You know, she played college basketball.
Mm-hmm.
And she wants to play basketball again. You know, I applaud the Tulsa Shock for signing her instead of, you know, having to deal with this whole, like, you know, hands-wringing moral outrage of, person who gets a felony should never ever be employed ever again because any person that would take them is just totally wrong, so they should just, like, sit at home, eat Cheetos, but I don't want them on unemployment.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the point of going to prison, right? I mean, you do your time, I guess, and then, like, justice has been served, right? You're supposed to come out of the correction system.
Yeah.
Corrected. So that you can re-enter society and be productive.
And just proof that Ari Fleischer is a good PR guy. I think Mark McGuire and them haven't had to go to jail for allegedly using steroids.
Fair point.
Well, fair point. I don't know how much McGuire is allegedly since he admitted it.
True. You know, yeah, they busted her on the lying about it.
Yeah.
So, well.
And, you know, McGuire just said when he was in front of Congress, I'm not here to talk about the past.
So, okay, fair enough. He sets the agenda.
Now, get your tinfoil hats out, everyone. We're going to take a special field trip off to that wonderful land of conservative Wingnutia. According to several conservative news sites, President Obama is planning to outlaw recreational fishing. It all starts with an opinion piece written by Robert Montgomery for ESPN Outdoors, saying, quote, "The Obama administration will accept no more public input for a federal strategy that could prohibit U.S. citizens from fishing some of the nation's oceans, coastal areas, Great Lakes, and even inland waters," close quote. Which led to this headline on Gateway Pundit. "Obama's latest assault on freedom. New regulations will ban sport fishing." The only problem? These regulations don't exist. What Montgomery was writing about is the Interagency Ocean Policy Task Force that has been charged by the White House with developing a comprehensive federal policy for managing the nation's waterways. Sure, they're interested in conservation and interested in setting new guidelines for fishing policies, but that includes commercial fishing policies that are threatening to deplete the world food supply.
Right.
Except they haven't gotten that far yet. All they've released is an interim report that discusses what their goals are, none of which involve a ban on fishing. But I mean, let it never be said that, you know, conservative right-wingers like Glenn Beck and, like, the rest of those morons don't just go from, like, point A to point Z with no stop in between.
It's insane, right? I mean, most countries have some sort of regulation of their fisheries, you know? I mean, you call it infringement of freedom or whatever, but, I mean, it's a limited resource. And if you just let everyone run, you know, run free in there, you have the crisis of the commons, right? I mean, you have a bunch of people exploiting as fast as they can with no incentive individually to go out and do anything to conserve it. I'm all for regulating this, you know? I mean, you should get a fishing license, you should fish to quota. I mean, I don't know. Anyway. Yeah, insane conspiracy theory.
Yeah, it's an insane conspiracy theory when there's so much legitimate stuff you can criticize Obama for, like expansion of the two wars, you know, continuing unlawful detentions, all sorts of things, but you're going to pick sport fishing. You really want to attach your trailer for November to sport fishing.
Well, you know, Hitler's first executive order was an order regulating for the humane execution or the humane butchering of animals.
You know who else who had government regulations?
Hitler.
You know who else
QED.
Took off? You know who else? Who else was a supposed illegal Kenyan that took office? Oh wait, that one doesn't work.
No, it doesn't work. We got other stuff. He's definitely a Nazi.
But speaking of African-American athletes, in a USA Today interview, all-star outfielder for the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim, Torrey Hunter, had some interesting things to say about race. "They're imposters. Even people I know come up and say, 'Hey, what color is Vladimir Guerrero? Is he a black player?' I say, 'Come on, he's Dominican. He's not black.' Baseball's African-American population is 8%. Compared with 28% for foreign players on last year's opening day rosters." Hunter went on to say, "As African-American players, we have a theory that baseball can go get an imitator and pass them off as us. It's like they had to get some dark faces, so they go to the Dominican or Venezuela because you can get them cheaper. It's like, why should I get this kid from South Side of Chicago and have Scott Boras represent him and pay him $5 million when you can get a Dominican guy for a bag of chips? I'm telling you, it's sad." He later elaborated, saying, "What troubles me was the word imposters appearing in reference to Latin American players not being black players. It was the wrong word choice, and it definitely doesn't accurately reflect how I feel and who I am. Hunter posted on the Angels' sponsored blog Wednesday afternoon. What I meant was, they're not black players. They're Latin American players. There's a difference, culturally. But on the field, we're all brothers, no matter where we come from, and that's something I've always taken pride in. Treating everybody the same, whether he's a superstar or a young kid breaking into the game. Where he was born and raised makes no difference.
Except those guys are worth a bag of chips.
Well, I mean, you know,
there's like all sorts of things wrong with this statement, right?
Well, I think, you know, like, his word choice, you know, I kind of liken this to, like, Alan Grayson.
Okay.
Where he's totally right, but the word choice that he was using, you know, everybody knows what he meant, but they're going to, you know, pull it apart for the word police.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, culturally, he's saying, you know, there's a very vast difference between, you know, like, Africans from the continent of Africa and African Americans here in the U.S. Like,
true.
There's a very big cultural set of differences. And he was basically talking about that, as well as the fact that, you know, these baseball sweatshop farms that they've got set up in the Dominican, you can just, you know, get tons of Dominican athletes really on the cheap.
Yeah.
No, and,
that's
you know,
really true.
I mean, Kevin Blackstone had a great part. There was one comparison Hunter made that was spotlessly correct, if not crudely said. It was that baseball is more likely to recruit black players from Spanish-speaking countries like the Dominican, rather than from his native Arkansas or anywhere else in the States. It is cheaper, as he said, to sign talent that isn't yet in Scott Boras' stable, or some other big-name sports agent. It's the difference between buying in bulk or individually. Baseball has indeed turned the Dominican, once home to plantations to produce sugar, into a plantation that produces baseball players.
No, that's true. That's true.
And if you're interested in seeing like what this kind of situation is like, there's a fantastic movie called Sugar about a kid from the Dominican that comes up. And it's amazingly done. And it was one of my top films from last year. It's really, really good. So we're going to take a brief break, and then we'll be back with Brian Tackett from the Undergrad Alliance to talk about education, taxes, and stadium funding.
Fun, fun, fun.
Oh, yes. Let's see if we got a fun song we can play. Let's go with...
We should hire a producer.
Then we'd be hiring people, Damien.
Yeah, that's true. All right,
I picked a song.
Okay, here we go.
Struggle.
Okay, welcome back to Not Another Sports Show. In the studio with us is Brian Tackett from the Undergrad Alliance, and on the phone with us is Gene Vanderport, noted lefty and head of Uniserv director of IEA Region 9. And full
how are you?
And full disclosure, I am Region 9 grassroots political activist for IEA.
Nice.
Really good to have both of you on today. We've been talking a lot about stadium funding, coaches funding, and other issues like that on the air. And how many people know that Ron Zook is actually the highest paid state employee?
Yes, absolutely true. If we could have Ron Zook take a furlough day, 11,000 other people could go back to work.
Wow.
Jeez. Yeah. Well, I found it funny
when
we
know where the money is. And the U of I keeps telling us, the unions at the U of I, they keep telling us they're broke. So we asked if we could just rent out the luxury skyboxes at the stadium, and we promised that we would recuse ourselves for a game day. Yeah. $50,000 per skybox. I mean, you know, we ought to be able to do something with that.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing. You know, and you have the U of I talking about, you know, furlough days.
Yeah, furlough days. They're talking about extension programs, particularly the labor extension program. There's like four people in the state that train, you know, 500,000 people to do grievance handling, you know, bargaining, how to analyze salary schedules, all that stuff. Well, they want to eliminate that department, you know, so they can do what? Send yet another mouse with their supercomputer to the Mars or something? I mean, geez, I mean, it's insane over there.
And, you know, and Eikenberry suggested a 20% tuition increase, potentially. I mean, this is absolutely ridiculous. And, you know, you have the University of California system and the just outright, you know, rebellion that's been happening at UC over these, you know, tuition, fee increases, since there is no such thing as tuition.
Well, I don't know how many people know, but that rebellion is happening here. Last week, on March 4th, we had somewhere between 300 to 400 students, undergrads, grads, service employees, clericals, professors, academic professionals. We marched on the Swanland Building. At the same time, about 300 to 400 people were occupying the Thompson Building in Chicago. And I just left my old union, had an anniversary today over in Danville. I came from the VA system. We were signing people up there. They said, we can't let the General Assembly do to our schools what they're doing. So we're signing everybody up to march on Springfield on the 21st of April. And I don't think we're going to have enough buses, which is the good news. So people are angry. They're tired of the priorities being what they are. They got plenty of room for corporations at the research park, but we're not even sure how we're going to feed the kids, clean the buildings, or let alone, oh, by the way, teach them. So, anyway, tough times.
Oh, yeah, and, you know, and we have it locally here, and you know, you have other universities like UC spending millions on the Golden Bears program. They actually forgave $30-plus million dollars worth of loans to the Golden Bears sports program. Yet they didn't have enough money to keep the library open.
Right.
And, you know, and I mean, it's even wider than just universities. We have, you know, cities being held hostage because they want taxpayers to pay for stadiums. The Washington Nationals, or as their own jerseys called them when they misspelled them, the Nationals, spent $600 million on a new stadium, most of it taxpayer money. The new Yankee Stadium that got built, actually, they ran out of the legal amount of tax breaks and tax money they could request to build the stadium, and they had to get a special exemption for more. Citi Field from the Mets, and Damian, don't you think if we bought the rights to Citibank with the public bailout, that it should just be called like Taxpayer Field?
Yeah, it should be Us Field.
Yeah, Us Field. We get like free tickets.
We the People
and stuff.
Field. Yeah.
Yeah, you think?
And you have all these stadiums with, you know, just holding cities hostage. I mean, Cincinnati is having a huge issue with their sales tax they had passed in favor of helping the Bengals and the Reds stay in.
Right.
And they decided that...
Well, you know, a lot of people aren't focusing on what's really going on around them. You know, we keep paying higher and higher tuition. We keep paying higher and higher tolls. We keep paying higher and higher sales tax. These are all regressive taxes, okay? They're regressive taxes. Every time they raise the price for a ticket to go to Memorial Stadium, that's a tax. And then, then we say, wait a minute, let's tax real wealth. Let's tax real wealth, you know, corporations. Let's tax people with making over $250,000. And everybody says, hey, we don't want any more new taxes. That's a terrible thing. It's going to drive away jobs. Well, listen, if it drives away some people off of Lakeshore, fine, let them go. We'll take over the factories. We can run it better. Anyway,
and
I'm on a rant there.
And you're talking about real wealth. Democracy Now, just on Friday, talked about the Insight Center for Community Economic Development that had a report that said that median wealth for single black women is a whopping $100. Single Hispanic women is $120, and for single white women is $41,000.
Yeah. But that's the great secret. I mean, it's an anti-tax teabag nation that doesn't know it's being had, and it's so sad. Anyway, it's about to make my hair get white.
And knowing Gene, his hair is a mane of flowing white. It's enough to get his hair turn white, Damien.
Nice.
There it is. It could be worse. I could have Neil Parson as a member. Anyway.
I wouldn't join any organization that would have me as a member.
That's it. That's right. They have me as your business agent. Well, guess what? You just did. All right?
And, you know, like in Cincinnati, the public schools have deferred taking their share of money for years from the sales tax. And now the county plans to cut back basic services, lower its legal bills, and drain the bond reserve fund with no plans to pay it back, all because the property taxes.
I spent most of the weekend talking to special needs speech pathologists, social workers, and other folks who take care of the most challenged kids in the county. We have 60-some people who do this work. 22 of them got pink slips this weekend. It's just absolutely absurd. You know, we don't make Buicks in public education. All right? We're not making Buicks. If Buicks don't sell, you can lay off a production line. Last time I looked, we got more kids in school needing education than ever. So it's like, okay, we got an epidemic. Let's lay off the doctors. Well, needless to say, this is a maddening time for us.
And, one of the things about education that I always found kind of funny was a lot of the legislators, well, I went to school once, so I'm an expert about education policy. I had a tooth extracted once. That doesn't make me a dentist.
How about this? I don't know if anybody saw Bill Maher here recently in the show yesterday. He was absolutely on. He says, the reason education is failing is because obviously it's the teachers. It has to be the teachers' fault. It's just like, okay, if I'm a dentist and I'm in a rich neighborhood, I get paid more than a dentist in a poor neighborhood. Thank God he's not paid on the basis of how many cavities aren't existing. All right? So, I mean, it's the same notion. The poverty rate in our schools in this area, in our area right here, 1993 was 30%. Today it's 70 to 85% poverty. So it's our fault that poor kids are more needy. Must be our fault.
Yeah, and we have tax money going to Soldier Field's renovations. They had over $100 million that went to renovating Soldier Fields from the city of Chicago back in the early 2000s. I remember in the 90s when Jerry Reinsdorf was threatening to move the Chicago White Sox out to Tampa Bay if they didn't give him tax money to build U.S. Cellular Field. You have these sports franchises in most every city that are holding taxpayers hostage. You're going to give us this money, see? Yeah. In any other place, that's just called robbery or extortion.
Depends who's holding the gun.
Yeah. if it's money that's being asked to, get spent publicly, then, we have, it's just another big tax and the tax eaters are going to get it. We've got to cut taxes. We've got to cut everything.
Yes, right. Well, you got one guy running for governor wants to do a 10% cut across the board. I think I know where a whole 10% ought to happen. But they start with these simplistic notions that there's so much waste, fraud, and abuse out there that somehow or another we can wring the system out. Well, after you get rid of the chancellor and say the president of the U of I, The waste part goes real quick. It's basic services that get cut, not the waste. So that's our concern.
And we wanted to bring Brian Tackett in here. He was on campus for the March 4th on March 4th. What was the environment like here, and what was a lot of the stuff that was being said here locally? Because, you know, this is a national issue about, you know, funding and taxes. What was it like here, since I had to be in Rantoul teaching that day?
Environment like when?
We got Brian Tackett in here, too, on March 4th.
Okay, yeah.
So, Brian, what was this like?
The organization I'm with is the Undergraduate-Graduate Alliance, not the Undergrad Alliance. A few of the key issues we were focusing on was, of course, the tuition increase, which is proposed for next year, which Neil said was going to be somewhere between 9% and 18%. And another issue we were focusing on was accessibility, because I'm not sure if any of you know, but there is this program created in the 60s called Project 500, where the university would bring in, they wanted to have at least 500 black students and 500 Latino students in each incoming undergrad class. And this was the first year since the 1960s that they have failed to meet that mark. And so we wanted, and as earlier was said, that we had 300 to 400 people who came out for the rally in front of Swanland.
I mean, you know, like this whole issue of accessibility, and I know there's a big push within the labor unions to get a tax increase, which Quinn did actually suggest in his budget talking points. And you know, this issue of accessibility, you know, universities are no longer going to be that place where, you know, middle income, blue collar parents can send their kids for an education. It's going to turn into, you know, a bigger issue of, you know, we spend tax money here, but you won't be able to send your kid here.
We have a slogan at the U of I, the labor coalition, the working class can't afford to go to class anymore. You know?
Sorry, there's only two headsets and there's three people in the studio, so I'm not on a headset. But
go ahead, Damian.
No, I'm pretty much done. I was just saying that, you know, this is a, you know, it was supposed to be a land-grant university. It was supposed to be that which was accessible to all people, you know, especially the working class of people who may not be able to go to one of the more elite or private universities. So accessibility is key. You know, it's essential to the mission of a land-grant university.
And, you know, and like even with all this tax money being spent, you know, it's amazing. You know, we can spend tax money on stadiums and stuff, and yet with the way that ticket prices and stuff are increasing, fans are losing accessibility to the stadiums that they're helping to build, or, you know, things are being, you know, everything's being built on the backs of the poor to give to the rich in this, like, really perverse, reverse Robin Hood ideology for some reason. Let's take from the people who have nothing, but we've got nothing. Right. And we're going to take that, too.
Right.
It's amazing. Like, it's all over the nation that this is happening. You know, in Indianapolis, they tried to find $32 million to help run Lucas Oil Stadium. You know, in Milwaukee, tax receipts, a drop in tax receipts due to the economic recession is going to push back the dates that they can pay off the bonds for Miller Field. Columbus, Ohio is trying to use public money to keep the Columbus Blue Jackets in town. Because when I think hockey, I think Ohio.
Even that is occurring here in Illinois. Like, I live in Rockford when I'm not in school. And during the summer, there was an issue where funding was cut from some libraries because it had to go to support the Ice Hogs at the Metro Center, which is a hockey team. Well, the Ice Hogs are a hockey team that play at the Metro Center in Rockford.
Sad.
You know, and Minnesota has become a central part of this right now because there's debate about a new Minnesota Vikings stadium, and they want to get public funds to pay for it. And one of the big issues that we've been talking about this in the labor struggles of the NFL is that the owners have had to spend more of their own private money to help develop these stadiums. And they want the players to take a concession in a pay cut of getting, instead of, you know, almost 60% of the, I think they get 59% of the money in revenues. And the owners want to see that go down to 41% because the owners have had to pay with their own money
to
make a stadium. And rather than, because these taxpayers are no longer going to pay for it, and it's no longer palatable to say taxpayers pay for a stadium in this recession. And so I think this says something about the priorities that we've got in this country, that, you know, we can spend millions on, you know, a new Yankee stadium that's already having concrete cracks and stuff because there's allegations that the mafia was involved in the building of that and built it on the cheap.
A little better. All
right, thank you.
And so what kind of things are being done locally to deal with these kind of taxes, especially for education, since we've kind of outlined, you know, the improper priorities, Gene? What kind of stuff's going on locally that we can start to organize around here, not only locally, but also nationwide, with this whole privatization of education with, you know, charter schools and firing the entire, you know, you brought up firing the entire production line. They fired an entire staff of Rhode Island teachers.
Right.
Because the testing wasn't up to snuff, and they said,
which,
you know,
which was praised by President Obama, by the way.
Yeah.
Well, I can tell you what's happening here is that we've now formed a coalition between the labor unions locally, service employees, AFSCME, IFT, stagehands, operating engineers, IEA, and obviously the graduate employees, and we've now have a unity program with the undergrad grad alliance, the cultural houses across the campus, and basically our whole pitch is we have a program of you know, cap tuitions, do away with tuition and you know, loan programs that are onerous, you know, fund that should all be federally funded anyway. You know, in Germany they pay for your education and you don't have to work to get a higher ed degree. So we're fighting on the tuition, and we're fighting for a progressive income tax, even though Mike Madigan says it's dead on arrival. Well, so we'll show him what's going to be dead on arrival. We're marching on Springfield for a reason, and that's part of our program. Also part of our program is to democratize the university, that if you're serious about shared governance, that doesn't mean one seat on the board of trustees. But, you know, they got a bill out right now that would stack the Board of Trustees with alumni. You know what? I'm an alumni. I may run as an alumni so I can be on the Board of Trustees. I'm announcing my candidacy today.
That is a great exclusive to have. Gene Vanderport announcing his potential candidacy for the Board of Trustees.
Yep. Awesome.
Yep, and, you know, Chapin Rose is a friend of mine. I'm going to see if he'll sponsor me.
That would be great.
So, you know, the program is pretty clear. You know, save our schools, save our state, quit fiddling around, fund us. All right? That's what you got to do. So, and if Springfield's where the money is, or where it should be, so come with us March on the 21st of April and remind these folks what their job is.
Yeah, it's amazing. And, you know, like, even some of the legislators I was talking at a GPA mini convention, and they were talking about their legislators saying, you know, well, we've got to make budget cuts. And my friend had mentioned to him, you know, well, a budget cut's not going to get us out of this. And the legislator responded to him quite bluntly, I know, but I'm supposed to say these kind of things.
Right. Right.
Like, they know, like, this isn't going to work.
What we know is that Illinois is like 50th in the country in terms of equity in public school funding. We're like 41st in terms of the poor income tax, progressive tax policies. We're the fifth richest state in the union. So we have a long way to go to convince people there's a lot more we can be doing to turn this state around. And it doesn't necessarily mean that we can avoid such notions as coming up with the money for a jobs program either. That can be done for about the same money as they bailed out the banks.
Oh, yeah. You know, they want to spend $15 billion on a, on a jobs bill. Because, you know, we're all worried about the Republicans that are now all of a sudden, like, fiscally conservative.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, gentlemen. Where were you from the years 2001 until January 19th, 2009?
Yeah.
You know, we're spending billions in wars, billions in foreign wars, billions for all sorts of other stuff, but nothing that can get, you know, social welfare.
Yeah.
Well, they have the consciousness of mayflies. I mean, it lasts about 16 seconds, and they forgot everything that happened just 2 years ago.
That's generous for Glenn Beck.
I think so. Thank you. But I didn't want to denigrate mayflies all that much.
Brian, you wanted to jump in here.
Yes, I've heard recently that the state of Illinois alone pays in taxes to the national, to the federal government for to sponsor the for the war over $30 billion each year, while the state only owes us less than, was it less than $30 million for the schools?
That's about right.
Yeah, it's amazing. You know, they want to cut all these different things, and there's different school districts around the state that are actually putting up on their, you know, their marquees, instead of having, you know, like PTO meeting, you know, like March 17th.
Yeah, right. No.
It's now become the state of Illinois owes us blank.
Ouch.
In Danville, it's $2 million. In Champaign, it's $1.5 million. In Urbana, it's about $1 million. Yeah. If I was that late in my payments to anybody, I'd be living on the street.
No, you'd be in jail right now if you were that late.
Well, that's absolutely true.
You know, if
no question.
I mean, it's amazing, like, the glaring incompetence of, like, not getting something done. Like, you know, if I didn't pay my bills, or if I was, like, a person that was holding up the federal government to, you know, pay me for something that only I was going, like, you know, that I was going to use to make private profit from...
Yeah,
I would get arrested for extortion double plus quick. But, you know, when we put it in the name of an owner, then it all of a sudden becomes okay. Or, you know, if you threaten to move a team out of the state because you're not going to get enough tax breaks.
Right.
I mean, this is absolutely, you know, ridiculous. And it's a way that different states, you know, funding-wise, especially, you know, our neighbors to near the north, Minnesota, this new fight over a new Viking stadium is going to be something to watch with, you know, their economy pretty much in the toilet too. And so it's been absolutely great to have you on, Gene, talk about education funding.
Thank you, guys. I mean, I love you guys. You're doing great work for our union movement, our independent media movement, and I just thank God you guys are here. So y'all take care, all right?
All right. Thank you, Gene.
All right. Take care.
All right,
bye.
Cool. And so that was Gene Vanderport, UNISERV director for the Illinois Education Association here in Region 9 out of the Champaign office. If you're interested in any education reform, you can come down to the IMC and talk to us on a Saturday afternoon.
Absolutely.
Anything else anybody wants to add? Baba Booey, Baba Booey?
I think that's pretty well covered.
Bueller. So, you know, this is a sports issue, you know, with the way that priorities happen, you know, of closing libraries in Rockford to help out a hockey team, you know, holding, you know, cities and states hostage in order to get a new publicly built stadium, to the fact that we might not even have football after this upcoming season because the owners have actually had to pay for their own stadiums. So this is, you know, hitting numerous things, numerous state employees, and as one of my friends told when I was talking to him about the topic of this show last night, you're going to have people that are, you know, they don't care about politics, but, oh man, are they going to be upset if there's no football?
Yeah.
And so it's up to, you know, progressives to connect these dots of things that might not, you know, normally be connected of, you know, sport franchises in a given city and what kind of tax breaks they get, you know, to all sorts of different issues related to education. As we see, we try to connect the dots during this hour of bringing up education funding. It's a matter of priorities for not only the state, but also the federal government.
Right. And it's like there's sort of become this habit, right? Like, you shouldn't have to, I mean, you shouldn't have to rely on public funding for a lot of these things. I mean, owners of the professional athletic teams are making lots and lots of money on this, you know, but you've established this culture where, you know, they just expect to get tax breaks or whatever in order to maintain their stadiums, and it's just crazy.
Yes,
anyway.
And so with that, we'll leave you with a little Matthew Grimm and the Red Smear, a little bit of a happy note for us. So tune back in next week from 2 to 3, or catch us on iTunes via podcast. Just search for Not Another Sports Show.
That's right.
When the purple regimes fall, when the World Bank gets the boot.